They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Joining me today on the Commons, I have my good friend, Carolyn Douglas. Carolyn is an author. She writes books by the pound, and by the way, she sells them by the pound, too. And I have one that'll give you muscles on your arms if you buy it. So we'll have her talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about her book. But I'm excited to have her in the studio with me. It's been pouring down rain, and she got in the car and drove for over 2 hours to come and see me and be with you guys. So, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, Shu, I've been waiting to see you again. It really was fun, even in the rain. It's quite a storm out there.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you came in. But when I saw the weather, I got here before it started raining. And then the skies opened up, and I've been worried sick about you.
Oh, no, don't worry. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm really happy to have you here. So you've been really busy, and you have some, I mean, you're not into the HOA business, but you have a really good understanding and knowledge of what basically happens, the big picture. You know what, Carolyn? I really want to focus on the big picture because so many people get so involved in their personal issues and they get so involved in what they're feeling, but they don't look at the big picture. They work and work and work and do all sorts of things that don't make a damn bit of difference.
Well, you mean in the end? They do make a difference in their lives. And I think I've listened to so many of your HOA stories, and I find that they are similar to the stories that I hear from people in a courtroom situation where they feel that their courtroom was corrupt, where their judges and the attorneys, there was something off and they didn't get justice. We see it all over the country in different institutions. And I have to tell you, from a big picture point of view, as an American, I'm frightened at what appears to me to be the nonstop attacks on democracy.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about the big picture, what I'm talking about is not just corporate America and not just politics and not just the HOA stories, the horror stories, the little things that affect people's lives. What I wanted to say to you when you said it doesn't make a bit of difference, sadly, I think that happens with so many different whistleblowers. And so we try to all get together and tell stories and listen to your show and listen to other shows. But we're each little tiny people that in the end, if we try to fix it on a case-by-case basis.
You can't.
And it ends up often subsuming people. I saw this recently at the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, and we were at the U.S. Congress, and we were so lucky. Congressman Pierce from New Mexico got us this wonderful room at the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives, and it was the investigative hearing room. And all day long, we listened to stories, but what I realized is that so many people are really caught up in the details of their stories, and they forget to stand up. I say it's like being a bird. You have to rise over the curvature of the earth and look down and see the pattern. And that's what I was trying to do, and I'm delighted. I am so delighted to be here today.
I'm so delighted to have you here.
I got the panel to come up with about 15 different proposed resolutions, and most of them, I have to tell you, mine included, are just batty. When you try to think outside the box about how do you solve a huge systemic problem, what do you do about, let's take HOAs, for example. But what do you do when you have almost, may I call it a mini government?
It is a mini government. It is a government.
Thank you. It's a mini government that duplicates a lot of the roles of government. For example, the condo fees you pay, that's kind of like a tax, isn't it?
It is. Well, it replaces it. Yeah, it's a double taxation.
It's a double taxation.
It's a double taxation.
And then you've got a separate set of fees. So the government provides certain kinds of, like, you know, sewer and infrastructure and...
Not always.
But what happens in an HOA is you end up privatizing that.
Yeah.
So you have perhaps a double fee. So you have the one that the government provides that it's already incorporated into your taxes, but then you've got your HOA fees. I think there was a third one. Besides services. Oh, you start getting the attorneys involved with HOAs. And it ends up almost becoming more than an assessment. It becomes I don't have to tell you, it's like singing to the choir here. But you end up with these enormous ripoffs that end up being transfers of wealth and property.
I'm going to take you one step beyond that. Somebody did I can't think of her last name, did a study. She's local. She was on the show some time ago. She did a story, and what she found was people in condominiums and a lot of HOAs are being pushed outside of the normal government participation, because if you have someone who's running for office, they're going to come and knock on your door.
Okay.
And they're going to introduce yourself. Hi, Carolyn. My name is Sue, and I'm running for da 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 da. But when you get into a condominium, they can't go up to your house, go up to your room. So you never get to meet the candidates. If you're in an HOA, a lot of them are gated. A lot of them have these, even if they're not gated, they have these policies that no trespassing, you can't come in, you can't. So the people who live in these things are being physically isolated from their local communities.
So they're like in a parallel community.
They're in these little pods all over the place. They're not part and parcel of what's going on.
So there's no more small town America.
There is no small town.
Which is, I can tell you, is dying. I drove across country. I took Highway 40, which I thought would be absolutely beautiful, through the Appalachian Mountains and across Oklahoma, which is an incredibly beautiful state with beautiful people. I was so surprised, but I made a point of trying to avoid chains. And I stopped, and store after store and little mom-and-pop restaurants, and they're closing, and they're already closed. And sometimes when I drive through the little towns, I would count how many empty stores there are. Silver City, New Mexico, I had been down there a few years before, and when I went back the next time, out of 30 stores on both sides of the street on one block alone, mm-hmm. two-thirds of them were closed.
Yeah.
And boarded up.
Yeah. And they're
you find this in little stores all across America. And now you're talking about these HOA pods that are out there, like alternative universes that kind of encapsulate you behind gated communities.
Well, even you don't even need the physical barriers. They're just not allowing people there. If you walk in, you don't belong here. Get out.
So it's a change in the culture of America over, what, two generations?
Well,
how long have they been around, really?
How long have they been around? Since, I think, they started in the late 60s. They didn't really become ubiquitous until probably the 70s, 80s. When they started mandating them across the country. Now, everything that's new is in an HOA, and everything that's not in an HOA is being torn down. and rebuilt into an HOA.
So it's like an amazing mindset that has political and social ramifications,
absolutely,
but no one ever voted on
it. Absolutely.
Other than voting with their money when they bought into such an association.
Well, the thing is, when you find yourself at odds with the association, you're told, but you agreed to this. Nobody agreed to this. Nobody. If you're buying a house and I said, here, sign this, it means you agree to being fined, you agree to being harassed, you agree to being abused, you agree to have some idiot come and tell you what color you can paint your house, you agree to have some moron decide how many rose bushes you have. You know, you're being nitpicked to death. You're being fined to death. You're being charged by these attorneys who, I mean,
so it can be an entire attorney industry.
It is.
Of creating these little nitpicking alleged violations.
Absolutely. Because the association.
That somehow get escalated not only into the force and effect of law, but they get escalated into punitive law. Punitive law. I mean, that's amazing, where they can lock you up or they can keep fining you and eventually sue you,
yeah,
and take your property to pay, yeah, your rampant out-of-control bills and your access to stopping that.
And you never hired the attorney. The attorney was hired by the association. The attorney gave the association all the advice. They said, don't worry about it. You don't have to pay us. We'll get it from the homeowner. Oh, okay. Have a nut. Go for it. And so they start going after the homeowner and start billing them and charging them interest and charging them late fees and charging them this, that, and the other. And pretty soon the legislature said, oh, okay, you can take their house if they haven't paid you. Then go ahead. You can foreclose non-judicially.
See, I hear about this in so many different pods, if you will, of life across America. Whether you're talking about, I've been studying RICO law, and I want to talk to your listeners about RICO and civil rights law as a combination.
Okay.
That is kind of a new combination, but it came about when I've been trying to learn all of the RICO cases and the topics that have happened, because it's a fairly new kind of law that was used for racketeering in the 50s, you know, to get rid of the mafia, allegedly. And Congress passed it. I forget the first year that it was passed. But it's been used in some rather creative ways more recently to go after, I think, political enemies as a conservative movement. That was what the anti-abortion clinics, they used RICO law to try to disseminate the protesters, to try to go after them individually and threaten them. But that's a two-edged sword. And I think it's important for people to understand that it's a two-edged sword and that in a time right now, I was looking at it in asbestos litigation. Is that frightening to study the growth of asbestos, which never existed in America until they started mining it in the 50s. And there were several corporations, and now it's ubiquitous across America. I think after I was listening on an audiobook, actually, on this asbestos litigation that went on for hours and hours, I went home and I actually threw out my hair dryer. And I don't throw many things out, but it turns out that the biggest source of asbestos are those 60s, 70s, and 80s hair dryers, where they're packed with asbestos and you're blowing it around. And if you don't have one that's not more than 20 years old, you've got this asbestos problem.
Wow.
That you can breathe. Who would ever guess that? That was, I mean, these little clever things that you read that scare,
yeah,
the heck out of you. But as I'm reading about and listening to the idea of asbestos litigation, and then I looked at it in probate and trust, because I've known that big law firms, the biggest law firms in my state, which was New Hampshire, but it's all over the country, are making what I call their overhead nut. What they're doing is they're quietly ripping off estates and going after the estates of incompetent people or elderly people. And they end up expending millions and millions of dollars by people that they claim are incapacitated. But the heirs end up with nothing, and there's a lot of litigation. So I was really fortunate to come across at the summit that I went to. That was one of the nice things, is you get to meet some interesting people with interesting ideas. Yeah. The woman is an attorney named Lisa Belanger, and she's in Boston. And she recently filed a RICO civil rights suit in one of these probate cases. And I sat down this week and I read it. It's like 58 pages long. It is enormous. And I got so excited.
Hey, somebody who wrote an 8-pound book.
Oh, yes, the 8-pound book, yes. The way to my heart and soul is through words.
I love that book.
But I'm actually getting quite picky about the words that I'm listening to these days. I feel like I am so tired of people telling me their whistleblower stories over and over and over. And I know they come and they want help, but there are no magic bullets. No. You said it at the beginning of the show that we each, well, you're not a whistleblower per se, but we each, I had to learn, it took me about 15 years to learn to write off my case, to say, you know, a really bad thing happened to me, and I didn't deserve it, and it was not only unfair, it ruined my life. It totally changed my life. And it took me about 15 years before I actually had an epiphany, a real epiphany, like sunlight kind of epiphany from the sky. And that was in the high desert of New Mexico. I used to have a sheep ranch out there. And what you find...
I can just see you on a sheep ranch. I love
can
it.
Can you imagine?
I can imagine.
I even tried to learn to lasso, but I ended up with a cowhand, thank God, who was really good at lassoing, because you can chase sheep till you're... Yeah, right. Sheep are just the best animal, though. What? I mean, if anybody ever wants just... They're a wonderful animal, not only their nature and their sweet faces, but all the different byproducts you get from sheep. But that's neither here nor there. But one of the byproducts is being a sheep herder. You're outside in the bright sun a lot. And I actually was feeling sorry for myself. And I'm thinking, God, why me? Why me? I didn't deserve this. And by golly, he kind of answered me, not in words.
Why not you, huh?
But all of a sudden, this epiphany that put it together was, he said to me, Carolyn Douglas, I did not give you all of these opportunities. I didn't give you law school, and I didn't give you, you know, the experiences you had with your husband, who was a former Supreme Court judge and a former congressman. I didn't give you these political experiences and these court experiences so you could go be whatever it is you thought you were going to be. And I did what Father Rohr calls, I fell into the second half of my life, which as you get older and you have these experiences and you realize, by golly, they're a pattern. There's a pattern to this. If I hadn't gone to law school, if I hadn't had these political experiences of writing laws and writing proposed laws for the legislature and studying the Constitution and studying the state budget, and then actually going in and trying cases in court and watching judges manipulate cases and rules and law in a way that was never intended, so they actually could decide a case outcome that's 180 degrees opposite of what the rule written in the book was supposed to be. And they would do this for their friends or their former classmates or other members of the club. And I came to realize that these kinds of favors, not only political favors, but judicial favors, were passed down over decades. It could take 10 years before you would get repayment. But if you had done a favor for someone, you could earn a chit that you could kind of cash in later in court and win a case. It results in attorney fees. It results in illegal and improper transfers of wealth, especially children in custody cases, alimony and marital settlement. But it was rampant in divorce cases. And that's where I cut my teeth on these kinds of cases. So I ended up with the 8-pound book, by the way, which is called The Dark Side, and it's on Amazon. And it's a treatise, because I used to write treatises. I've written for 5 different legal publishers in America and nationally, and I learned to write, but I write in a way for ordinary people to understand. And I wanted to explain to people how the court system got in this terrible mess that I say is really akin to the Catholic Church. Now, this week,
yeah,
I don't want to date the program, but in all fairness, I wrote about the Catholic Church 15 years ago and the priest pedophilia problem.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best judges, bravest judges I have ever heard of is named Constance Sweeney. And she's in Massachusetts. And her bravery came when she ordered the Archbishop Bernie Law, actually, I think he was a cardinal. At the time, he'd been elevated to cardinal, to disclose in discovery in a court pedophilia case, that he had to open up the files of the Catholic Church and show the victims what the church had been doing in ways of discipline. And she ordered the release of thousands of pages. And I know that the Catholic Church around the world went into shock, because for years they had self-regulated in secret and in private. And they kind of huddled informally behind something they called canon law.
Yeah.
Which is a big fat law book, by the way, and I just happened to have acquired that along the way so that I could study canon law and write about it in my book. Courts are like that now, where they're taking the law that they wrote for themselves, but they're twisting it case by case by case. And so you actually end up with cases in America that are not decided by any law. They're only decided by what I now call fake law. Fake rules, fake law, fake cases, fake statutes. So the legislature will write and pass a law that reads in a certain direction, but a judge in trial, in the press, in the heat of what happens in trial or afterwards, will twist that into a new law. If I can give you an example.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is fascinating.
A case that I was involved in, the judge created a law doctrine that she called, I call it, merger-fusion.
Merger-fusion.
Fusion. And she made a new contract law. Now, I love contracts. I really like the nitty-gritty detail that goes into either estate planning or contracts, where you have to
always a contract law.
You betcha.
Yep.
And so when you write them, it's a lot like playing chess. You have to be able to think 3, 4, 7 steps ahead. You have to be able to think of the permutations and the different combinations, the unintended consequences. You have to be able to stand back and say, what's not included in this law? What would make this law better that's not included? And of course, a lot of times that's rights and remedies or attorney fees, you know, for those people who become the victims. And that's what's happened in the civil rights laws that were brought forth in the 80s. So you've got 83, you've got 85, you've got 86. But here's the good news, listeners. In the last 2 years, Congress has made 3 different remedy changes to those old civil rights laws. So they are remediation, and they're helping those civil rights laws have legs to cover more and more people and to provide them with things like attorney fees, which might level the playing field. Now, I want to get back to the church in a minute, but I'm going to jump right here back to RICO. Because this racketeering charge, it's really interesting, and I'm exploring the concept of bringing state claims against state actors in federal court under a combination RICO civil rights law. Now, it's tricky, and I'm not practicing law here. I'm a I like a lot of law theory.
A guest and a friend. That's what you are.
But I do. I like to think about law. I love law. You know, it's kind of part of my DNA. And so I hate it when I see law corrupted.
Yeah.
And when I hear about not just a few people, not just 100 people or 1,000 or 10,000 people, I hear about millions of people across America being hurt when they go to court in a way that is illegitimate. And I think kind of back to that big bird's eye view, and I think, what happened? What's the unintended consequences of everybody joining an HOA all over America? What does it do to our children and to the next generation?
That's been my question, yes.
And to our democracy?
Yes.
What does it do to democracy? What are the unintended consequences? Now, I first saw this when I was writing a family law book, and I forget whether it was for Equity or Butterworth, but I was writing a treatise on family law, and I was studying where no fault came from. Now, way back then, this tells you how old I am.
I don't have to ask you.
You don't have to ask me. But I am old, old, old. And back before there was no fault, and I was really surprised to hear, I loved Ronald Reagan, and I was surprised to hear that the first no-fault law came out of Ronald Reagan's desire to marry Nancy. He was governor of California. They only had this fault kind of based divorce, and the legislature in California passed no-fault divorce, which was kind of a present to him. But it was passed by the legislature, no fault.
Okay.
So that you didn't have to prove that somebody was an adulterer or you know, an idiot or incompetent before you could get divorced. So it allowed what they called civil no-fault divorce. And what happened is things that start in California, sometimes, I think it happens on both coasts, they become like a tidal wave across America. And they are funded, this is my personal theory, they are funded by the lawyers and the bar. Because passing these kinds of laws exponentially increases the income for both lawyers and law firms, and it creates this whole new bunch of business that never existed before.
Yeah.
It's a real money-making, class-distinguishing, unintended consequence of passing laws or the social things that happen. In our society, where do they come from? You and I like to think they come out of the legislature, right?
No, we know better.
Yeah, we do.
We know better.
We do. It just seems like the legislature has caved in. And I think people say it's the executive, but true, the executive branch has become much more powerful. But I'm telling you that the legislature has lost grounds as the third branch of government has stolen it from them.
Yeah.
Anyway, to get back to this, how do you stop a tsunami?
How do you stop a tsunami? Good question. I want to know the answer.
Okay. So this is my theory.
All right.
I'm thinking maybe you use the new RICO law and the amended cleaned up civil rights law in the same lawsuit, where you can end up suing state actors who abuse their powers, and you sue them under color of law. So they are abusing citizen rights under color of law. I'll tell you, if anybody wants to head on over to good old Google and look up RICO, there are a it's a complicated law. It would be really tough to do it yourself. There are, I think, 37 different parts that allow you to use to go into federal court. They hate you to go into federal court. Federal court has a fast track, and it's difficult to do and whatever. But the idea, and they would like to stand back. Now, I lost my license to practice law. The appeal that I filed, the U.S. Supreme Court threw it out, saying, oh, that's a states' rights question. We aren't even going to look at this question. Younger says we don't interfere in states' rights. So I'm telling you, listeners, that if you want to, if you have the kind of claim that is so egregious and you haven't been able to get remedy or restitution, and it appears that there is this, whether it's a bar monopoly conspiracy or a judge conspiracy or let's say HOA officers together with the judge and the sheriff and state actors is the phrase that I'm using. But if you have a rather complicated scenario, or you know someone that has it, I really think that we can never, like you said, Shu, I don't think we can ever rectify our own problems.
You can't. I mean, it's ridiculous to even try.
So this is a play it forward. It's worth the 2 cents you paid for it, Shu. But the idea that there is...
I must have been feeling really rich at the time.
Maybe lunch. I'll tell you what. I'll buy lunch.
I was going to buy you lunch. But yeah.
Oh, we'll have to fight over the check. The whole idea that there might be a new vehicle out there in the legal realm that allows state citizens to go to federal court to get their constitutional rights. Now, we're talking 14th Amendment equal protection rights. Do you have rights to due process? Do you have rights to notice? Do you have rights not to be arrested? I was amazed at my panel at the summit how many people in the room had been illegally arrested, me included. I mean, it's just, it was so amazing that I bet more than half the people in the room, certainly all but one of the panel, had been falsely arrested under color of law for doing things like the HOA, you know, when they want to silence you. It's part of a pattern and practice that if you become an outspoken person criticizing a powerful system, I don't know how you've avoided. Have you avoided being arrested in your career?
Yeah, I've avoided. You know, I've never been victimized.
I know you. I know.
I've never been victimized. I absolutely hate bullies. And what I found disgusting was the fact that people were reaching out and trying to fix these problems they found themselves in for no real reason. And I started studying it. And I thought, well, if there's one thing I can do, is I can bring, I'm not an expert, but I can bring the experts in and have them talk about it and provide that information that is so desperately needed. And so this is year 19 that I'm doing this.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. and bringing the people in and hopefully...
And bringing them information, because what I see so much of is that we end up lacking hope. And people who get caught in these traps of saying, this is America, they can't do that to me.
Yeah.
You can't falsely arrest me. You can't take my property or my children or my parents' estate.
Yeah, they can.
You can't do those things, and they do.
Yeah, they can.
And they victimize, and we each end up being little lonely people out there alone. Now, every year, those of you have probably heard about it, but every year, the last... couple of days of July, there is an organization called Acorn 8 that sponsors, along with about a half dozen other organizations, this Whistleblower Summit. It's always at Congress, U.S. Congress. You can't miss it. You go to Congress. The last 2 days of the, it was July and the first day of August this year. And you will find thousands of whistleblowers from all walks of the country. And so you can find people who have generally experienced some form of what you have experienced. Part of the problem, Shu, we've talked about it, is you become desensitized and numb to those stories.
Yeah, you do, which is why I'm not doing them anymore. I have a website. People can tell their stories. It can be cathartic. They can get it off their shoulders. And I'm hoping that legislators will go there and look at them and read them and see that they're getting the same stories from every different state in the union. Because every time a homeowner goes and says, you need to fix this, the industry's there saying, it's an isolated incident. You don't have to worry about
it. And the industry is powerful because they have all the money that's collected.
Your money.
They have your money, but they are taking, and what I found, somebody reminded me, and that was an example of one of the remedies that people from the audience just stood up and shouted, began shouting at the end. But they're saying, for the lawyers, look at the IOLTA slush fund. And you think, what's IOLTA? I-O-L-T-A. And it is the slush fund of each state bar, because they've passed a regulation, the court have, that requires everybody who hires a lawyer and pays a retainer, they don't get their own interest. The interest off their money. So you give your attorney $5,000 as a retainer, and until he has earned, she has earned that money, they have to put it in an interest-bearing account. And that goes to the state bar, which is a trade union. It is a corporation trade union, and they have amassed millions and millions and millions of dollars. So
in addition, just the interest of all this money.
Just the interest. I call it the golden crumbs.
Wow. Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing how much each state bar has in this slush fund. And if you ever try to get an accounting, you can't get an accounting. And nobody in Congress, nobody in the state legislature is standing up and saying, Bar Association, give us an accounting of your IOLTA funds. And what you'll find is the IOLTA is the bar associations now are a series of corporations. There will be some that are for profit and some that are not for profit. They use these corporations to get over, $1 billion from the U.S. Congress to help pro se people. But by the time it gets broken up into block fund, block grants, and traced down, I think in New Mexico, the year that I traced it back there, only $17,000 went to the law school for a pro se clinic. And that pro se clinic had closed most of its doors and was only doing landlord-tenant law. So most pro se people are not getting, even though the funding is there. So they form these interlocking corporations. Oftentimes they have the same name, but one will be a profit and the other will be a not-for-profit. Then they'll slightly change the name, so you might have three or four or five different corporations in each state running the bar. And then they'll have a disciplinary arm. And whenever the legislature gets really aggrieved about judicial misconduct, because the public has stood up, as I did in 2000 in New Hampshire, and the legislature voted to hold an impeachment investigation and then a trial of the entire Supreme Court. So the public gets real aggrieved, and all of that is a political process that I believe doesn't really work. It'll be very interesting to see what happens in West Virginia, where the legislature has voted to impeach. That means an investigation.
I saw that. Yeah, I think I
of the entire
that.
Body of Supreme Court judges.
Yeah.
And they've needed that ever since Massey Cole. I mean, that sounds like an incredibly corrupt elected body where they actually have pulled back cases that have already been decided, but a new judge gets elected whose husband is involved in something, and then they'll have a revote and pull it back and change it around. That was recent. Then there's the outrageous spending, the lavish spending on their stuff. But that's more Chicago-style corruption. That's not the kind of corruption that I generally talk about and that I wrote about in my book and that I am aware of. This is a much more sophisticated kind of corruption. I call it court cronyism, where they trade favors. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes training, trading of favors, and it can last over many years. And it all happens by people who are insiders in the court system. And when you report, they're like the Catholic Church. They self-regulate in secret. Now, Constance Sweeney blew the Catholic Church apart with her first order ever in 400 years that said, you will stand up and tell us what you've done with these priests to discipline them. And that was in Boston, and it led to Bernie Law. I think they sent him back to the Vatican, where he retired and is probably still in penance.
Wow.
But what they've done is they've created, like your HOA, they've created an alternative universe for discipline.
Yeah.
That's not the same discipline that they apply to citizens.
Right.
So we as citizens across the country get one system of discipline, and yet the judges and attorneys have their own secret internal system just for themselves that doesn't work. So what happens is you have an incentive to continue the crony corruption.
Yeah.
And it grows and grows and grows.
This is such an important discussion because this is across the board, you know.
Well, I see it happening in so many different walks of life.
Yeah.
That it now seems to me it's almost like American citizens versus the rich and powerful.
Yeah.
And that's so disheartening.
It is. I agree.
And then, of course, the kind of politics we have now make decent people not want to run. This, I call it the dirty underwear politics, where talk radio just churns and churns this stuff that really has nothing to do with true corruption, but they fill the airwaves with things that avoid this whole issue. Now, Congress may be hearing, I'm not sure they're hearing well enough, we certainly are there on the Hill talking, but this whole idea that Senator Grassley and others jumped on the bandwagon and did some reform legislation to help extend civil rights acts, which were only being allowed for civil rights violations based on the traditional race, sex, color, but it didn't apply to religion. Everybody. And that was the only way, and you couldn't get attorney fees in religion, and you couldn't get attorney fees. And it's so important to try to level the playing field that I think, anyway, that's my study of the week. Anybody that wants to go look up RICO, there are 35 different sections. And if you want to move your claim from a state-based claim and into a federal court where you can get a whole different set of judges that I have more faith in, perhaps, but at least it gets you out of that state cronyism.
Yeah.
And you want to use federal civil rights violations as your cause of action. And you want to get, sometimes it's just an injunction, sometimes it's a reward. I think it's 3 times damages generally on civil rights claims, but I'm not positive, so you're actually going to need to talk to a real attorney and not just somebody who loves the law.
Well, you are a real attorney.
I am not. I am a person who loves and writes about the law. And it's just something I've done for years.
So in Florida, there was an attorney, and he represented someone who was being hounded, harassed, and abused for flying a flag, George Andrus. And I had him on, Barry Silver was the attorney, and I had him on a number of times, and he did it for free. He took the case and said, because George was retired, didn't have the money, he said, don't worry about it. He says, I'll take the case, and he worked on it for years, and he won.
It does take years. It probably you're looking at 2 to 4 years or more.
Oh, at least. He took this. When he won, he asked the judge for his fees. He was willing to accept anything the judge gave him. And if he didn't give him anything, that was okay with him too, because he said, I'm a simple man, I live simply. At the time he wasn't married, he didn't need the money, but this is something that I do because I think it's right. Judge looked at him and said, what were the odds of you winning this case when you took it? Well, the odds were 0, because nobody thought he would ever be able to win the case. So he awarded him his fees, and he said, well, you're not trying to screw them. I mean, these fees are really reasonable considering all the thing. But apparently there's a multiplier. Because the odds were 0, or very, very low, to win the thing, there was a multiplier, so he awarded him whatever he asked for times, I can't remember what it was, I think it was 3.
So I think that's the statutory multiplier. There also is, in Arizona and New Mexico, 6 or 7 other states, there is a fraud statute that allows a higher multiplier. I've seen as high as 17 times.
You're kidding.
Why? I'm not, but that's a state statute, so I'm not sure if you can get that in a federal claim. But the idea that there are multipliers out there, and that's the 83, that was the civil rights correction laws that went into effect this year and last year. So it's worth looking it up. And, Shu, if any of your listeners want to contact me about this whole RICO concept, I can't practice law, but I can send you the RICO statute and put you in touch with a couple of attorneys that I know that are working on this. And they're welcome to contact you through the station. And, I mean, I really kind of lost hope in the idea of doing things one case at a time and correcting the system.
You can't do it one case at a time.
I know.
You can't.
And so my probably ridiculous idea, but I'm used to thinking outside the box and I'm used to writing legislation, was I proposed as my possible remedy that Congress require all judges to carry liability insurance. Insurance companies would love it if every judge in the country, federal or state, everybody who's going to be a judge is required to have liability insurance in case they act outside their judicial purview. Now, judges have invented this doctrine called judicial immunity. It's called qualified immunity. But it means that they have to be acting in their official capacity and they have to be doing it under color of law, but if they are intentional in their fraud, they are not acting in their judicial capacity. If there is this conspiracy or this court cronyism, as I call it, where they're trading favors and helping each other, and they work together to do that as a conspiracy, then that's not within their official capacity. And so to the extent that judges might have to carry insurance to pay people who are damaged by those kinds of acts.
You'd have to go to court and sue them, right, to get that?
I don't know. It depends on how Congress or a legislature would set that up. They also can set it up as a fund. In New Mexico, they set up a board that was supposed to oversee people who worked in court, transcriptionists who make the record.
Yeah.
Because what I found in this one case is that when the judge really went off the handle and committed this fake law where she made up a law that doesn't exist and then used it to dismiss the whole claim. She said, you violated a law that doesn't exist. But everybody went along with her and they played this big charade in the trial. And she did that. When I went back to get the audio, it's only like a couple of bucks, and I would order the audio from every single hearing, every single trial. What I found is that last day, they wouldn't give it to me right away. They waited almost a week.
Wow.
And that's because the transcriptionist was erasing the audio. And then she went backwards and erased the words from the pages, although she did leave a half page blank. Now, I've heard this in Tommy Dean's case in New Hampshire, same thing. I mean, he was actually sent to prison, and it took him at least 6 months to get his transcript. And there were three or five exculpatory sentences that he knew. When a judge accuses you of a criminal act in court, I personally can attest you will never forget it. It's seared into your brain, so you know it's there, but it's missing from the official record. Now, in New Mexico, they have a commission that's supposed to investigate this, and they require all court recorders to be bonded. And it turns out in this case, not only was she not bonded, but the commission is not acting. They didn't really perform under FOIA. You know, it's a whole nother career once you start to want to expose this kind of corruption to build a case. And that's why these kinds of cases, I think people who go to court and who lose unfairly, illegitimately, actually have to step back and do a lot of soul searching and praying about whether they want to go ahead with it. It affects your life. It affects your relationships, your families. You certainly, in my case, I lost my career and I lost my job. And it affects everything for the rest of your life. You do as what Father Rohr called falling upward. So you change from that innocent, naive achievement loading thing that you do, acquisitions and accumulations, in the first half of your life. And if you're really, really lucky, when it hits in the second half, is you realize that it's a gift. It is a gift from God to let you see in this big view the kind of thing that you're talking about, Shu. It's not about the little details and the little stories. Those are the incidents that, of course, have to prove it. But it's the big picture that says, can any of us have an impact in our lifetimes? You have 19 years of giving people new information. That's kind of why I wanted to come on your show today. I actually wanted to talk a lot about this idea that I have that judges are putting out fake law. They know it's fake law. They're making it up in the courtroom and they're delivering it with great authority. And when you take it up on appeal, you'll find that you are ridiculed and insulted and told you're incomprehensible and you're stupid and you're a crook. And you'll be insulted a lot. But that's all designed to make you go away and shut up. Once you recognize it's just a pattern, it's not personal to you. It's to get you to be quiet. Then you realize that even if you don't have anything else, the idea that I get to drive down here in the pouring rain
and, guys,
and see you and go out to lunch and tell listeners, hey, there might be hope on the horizon. You know, Congress isn't dead. Senator Grassley's office has been working. They've made some changes to civil rights law. And now with this new RICO idea, if you can combine them together, it may be that if 50 of these cases pop up all over the country, it may be that someone in the court system will recognize that there is something very, very wrong. Are they going to voluntarily change it? Probably not. But this is the biggest club I've been able to see that might be able to force a change. I think it takes...
What I find really disheartening is not just fighting the industry, because I understand them. I understand the fact that they're trying to make things better for their industry, and that's what industries do. That's what lobbyists do. That's what all of that does.
Well, I'm thrilled about the church. I see this, the Catholic Church. I see this latest report on 300 more incidents in Pennsylvania. We've turned the corner. The church has turned the corner. They can't hide from it. And civilian authorities are saying priests have to stand for trial. No longer can you just hide them in Rome and send them off to be penitente somewhere. Oh, he's going to live a life of penance, or we've transferred him someplace else.
Oh, that's bullshit. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. That worked for like the first 90 years.
Oh, when we go out, I'm going to tell you about Rasputin.
Oh, you can't tell me now? All right.
Well, we're not going to have time, but I want to finish talking about this, because you've got me all excited about this, and we've got a couple of minutes left for the end of the show. But before I let you go, I want you to promise to come back and expand on some of these ideas.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, and not all of my ideas are you know, really workable in the end. This is not an original idea for me. I've given you the name of the attorney in Boston who came up to me and told me about it, and I am blown away with her work. She is brilliant, I think, and very courageous. And that doesn't mean necessarily that it'll be successful, but I do like to applaud and recognize those people that risk their careers, that risk their livelihood, that put it all on the line for what they think is right. Not because there's a reward in it or because they're going to become a celebrity, but because it's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do.
And you do it because you can't turn your back and walk away.
You have to do it. You have to. You can't just... sit back, shrug it off, and say, oh, well, someone needs to do something about it. Well, guess what? That someone is you. That someone is me. So,
well, it's all over the country. It's rampant. It's in so many different, whether it's in the housing industry or the banking industry or, like I said earlier, the asbestos industry or the HOAs or the court system. The corruption and the greed has taken over. It's impacting our daily lives. And I think that if we have a small but powerful group of people who communicate with each other, who share these ideas with each other, that we don't just have to sit and keep telling our stories over and over again. That was futile. That wasn't really making the kind of progress that, I don't even know how to say it. I'm saying, Congress, clean up the swamp. Take back your power. The courts have taken your power and your money.
Yeah.
Congress, take it back.
I start acting like Congress. Thank you, Carolyn. I do hope you will come back.
Oh, I can't wait.
You can't wait. I can't wait either. Thank you, everybody. You're going to love this.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.